Hi, everyone. Welcome to this latest in our series of Unlocked. And I'm delighted this evening to be joined by Matt Warman, Conservative MP for Boston and Skegness since 2015?
Yes.
With a majority, we should mention your majority, of over 25,000, I believe.
At the moment.
You've been a Minister of State, you've been a Parliamentary Undersecretary for Digital. I've been told I have to ask you questions about digital because you were a technology editor at the Daily Telegraph as well. But, I mean, it doesn't matter what your answer is on the digital questions because I won't understand them. So that'll be an easy bit we'll do towards the end.
Good to know.
And finally, because we have to say these things and know where people stand, you supported Rishi Sunak over Liz Truss in the 2022 leadership campaign. I'm never sure what questions to ask, you know, whether it should be Leave versus Remain, who you supported in leadership campaigns. You build up a picture. But just, I mean, you're a prominent, I think you're one of the senior people in the One Nation group of Conservative MPs. Just tell us what that group is, will you, for the record?
So I think I'd characterise One Nation as the pragmatists in the middle ground of the party. Like, in terms of numbers, it's the single biggest bloc. Mm-hmm. There's sort of 100 plus that are sort of more or less openly declared in that sense. And it's pragmatism that characterises that. I think it's people who broadly think that if you've got the middle of the population here, we think most people's political views are pretty close to mm-hmm. the sort of, the standard deviation is pretty small. And therefore, if you want to be in charge, if you want to do all the good that you believe politics can do, you have to appeal to that centre ground. And that's partly an argument about winning elections, and it's partly an argument about what's the right thing to do.
I mean, is it fair to characterise you as being on the group as being on the left of the Parliamentary Conservative Party?
So I think there's too many of us for that to be the easy characterization.
Right.
But I think we're the numerical and the ideological centre ground, right? There are people who I think would probably think of themselves as, if you think of it in left and right terms, too far to the left, and people who would definitely think of themselves as too far to the right. So everyone always thinks their own opinions are in
yeah.
the middle. But I think it's certainly for the majority of them. I think for the majority of us, we would certainly genuinely think of ourselves in that middle ground.
Okay. And I mean, part of me gets the sense that you've never really recovered from the fact that you lost so many of your leading lights. I mean, so many of the MPs who were part of the One Nation group who had a strong public profile are former MPs now, aren't they? I mean, you've been particularly hit by that, haven't you?
I'm not sure that's true. I think I'm always slightly nervous about sort of identifying members of the cabinet because they can speak for themselves. But people routinely characterise the Chancellor, the Education Secretary, the Health Secretary
right.
as very much on the One Nation end of the spectrum. So I think Rishi's appointed genuinely tried to appoint a very balanced cabinet that reflects different parts of the party. And that is, you could argue that is a necessity of it for any prime minister, but I think it also reflects his sense that it is the middle ground that's where you win elections.
I mean, we'll come back to the question about whether it's also a necessity because you happen to have a very divided party at the moment that is quite factionalised. But is it fair? I mean, it strikes me as fair to say that despite your size, it's other factions that hog the limelight. I mean, the Tories on the right of your party seem to hog the headlines far, far more and sometimes to make the running far, far more. Do you think that's fair or is it just mistaking noise for influence?
I'd say some of it is mistaking noise for influence, but I think historically, you're also right that people who have thought of themselves as middle ground pragmatists who would sort of perhaps lazily characterise themselves as the sensibles, have allowed themselves to think, well, for the sake of party unity, we need to maybe take on too much from one edge of thinking. What you've seen over the last year or so is a much more muscular, much more public approach from the One Nation group. And that's partly been a reaction to, as you say, the noise that's been out there, but it's also been a genuine desire to say, look, we've got an election coming up. We want that narrative surely to be the most electorally attractive. And I simply don't believe that the Tory party's best chance of winning another term comes from looking particularly to one end or the other of Conservative support.
I mean, is that a sort of complicated way of saying, in some ways, you've just been too bloody reasonable? I mean, I remember thinking, you know, during all the struggles over Brexit, the thing that defined for me the ERG was they were willing to burn the house down. I mean, they were willing to collapse the government, they were willing to issue threats, and I always got the sense that even though you had, many people in your group had a different agenda to them, everyone knew you weren't as willing as they were to do so, which sort of is a bit of a weakness, isn't it?
So I think you're right that pragmatism can definitely be seen as a sign of weakness. I think the debates over Rwanda have seen us take a genuinely more muscular, more firm position on some of this stuff. But I think also, yeah, you're right. There is when you have a very small majority, as Theresa May did, then relatively small groups get the opportunity to say, look, thus far and no further, and we matter. And I think we are currently in numerically different territory for the government. And we're also I think, as I say, need to continue to make that case that if you want to appeal to the public, you don't do it from even the mainstream political parties. You don't do it from the extremes of them. And the Labour Party found that out via Jeremy Corbyn. We've seen how that ends. I think there's a real prospect for the Conservative Party to avoid that fate. But okay, we don't do it by veering to one edge.
This is just nosiness. You don't have to answer this if you don't want to. But how does the group work? I mean, to what extent do you say, OK, we've got the Rwanda bill coming forward, let's coordinate a position. Do you meet? Do you vote? Do you agree on a stance? Do you agree that this is our... I mean, I remember I once, this is a whole different story, went to an ERG meeting, and it was very, very... it was very formal.
You're more in with the Tory party.
They had minutes, and they had officers, and it was... I mean,
the practicalities is that there are weekly meetings on Mondays at 6 o'clock, kind of thing. But there's never been a one nation whip in the way that the ERG have talked about having whip, and that is to some extent because there's too many of us. And also, historically, there's always been a big proportion of the group that are serving in government, and it's very different to ask people to take a position that would require them to speak in theory to potentially resign a position or whatever. So they're the practicalities. But no, we don't have minutes and we don't have a secretary. Although I'm quite envious of you going to an ERG meeting.
Well, I'll tell you about it later. But I mean, it wasn't that exciting, to be honest. But this is just my curiosity. I'm sorry, this is boring you all. I'm just quite curious about how these things work. But do you know? Do you know who the members are? So, I mean, do you have a list? I mean, is there a WhatsApp group that people get kicked out of or allowed into because they've become one nationed?
There is a very popular WhatsApp group that people sometimes ask to join and are usually admitted to.
Okay, all right. Okay, enough about that. So just in the last, 5-10 years, can you point to specific policies where you just think, yes, that is where we influence that. That policy came out the way it did because we played the game well.
So I think there's lots of things. The most obvious recent one is Rwanda, right?
Yeah.
Where there was a huge and completely legitimate argument about what is the best way to achieve a certain outcome, where there is, despite reports to the contrary, there is almost total unity within the Tory party on the necessity to do a thing, to make immigration policy work. There is significant disagreement on the best way of doing that. No one's going to pretend otherwise. But the fact that Number 10 came out with a bill that was on a knife edge and was under huge pressure to go down one route rather than another, and stayed where it was. And that is a real testament to the relatively greater stubbornness of the One Nation. And I think that is to all our benefit. I think you can go back. So lots of people would characterise a lot of the policies of David Cameron and the sort of legacy of David Cameron, that reshaping of the Conservative Party to be both electorally popular and fundamentally more socially liberal as a one nation agenda. And I think We are largely, not solely, but we are largely made up of people who joined the Conservative Party, who were elected as members of Parliament under the influence of David Cameron.
Yeah, okay.
And I think it's the lazy version is to say, well, this is the Cameroon end. And that's not true. The world has moved on somewhat since then. But that agenda, whether you think of gay marriage or whether you think of Rwanda or all things in between, that I think is where a lot of us would see ourselves.
I mean, on the question of David Cameron, did you see his appointment partly as a sort of as a sop to people like you? Did you see that as a sort of internally facing gesture as much as a let's have a foreign secretary with a bloody good address book?
No, I don't think I would have seen it as a bid to appeal to one part of the party. I think the Prime Minister genuinely sees him as someone who is bringing a set of unique qualities. And it's no secret that lots of people have mixed feelings about anyone holding those sorts of offices from the House of Lords. And the House of Commons is wrestling with how to make sure he is able to undergo the kind of scrutiny that I think is legitimate. But I think a lot of us are very glad to see David back on the front line of politics.
You can pass on this one, but is he in the WhatsApp group?
No, he isn't.
All right, okay. Just on immigration, actually, I genuinely don't know this. So you say there's a degree of unity in the Conservative Party on dealing, presumably with the small boats, the sort of irregular. But when it comes to legal immigration, there are, I mean, you know, I remember Liz Truss as Prime Minister hinting that she wanted to liberalise things yet further. I mean, is there are the One Nation group relatively comfortable with where regular immigration is at the moment? Is there a concern about the number? I mean, do you have a...
So I think there's a broad consensus across the party, wherever you sit, that those numbers of both legal and illegal migration are very high mm-hmm. and don't have broad public consent, if that makes sense. And mine is a constituency where immigration has always been a huge issue since the liberalisation of EU immigration rules, and we saw huge expansion in places like Boston, where agricultural work was this magnet, and there were no transitional controls. So, on a personal level, I'm acutely aware of the strains that puts, to some extent, on public services, but it's also a mixed bag. I'm conscious that on the one hand, my local GPs are under a lot of pressure because of immigration. On the other hand, the maternity unit is still open because of immigration. So it is swings and roundabouts. On the other hand, the challenge comes around public consent. The challenge comes around saying to people, for instance, in an area like mine, you've seen huge change over a very short period of time. Do you feel like anyone ever had that conversation with you? And certainly in a place like Boston, the answer is simply no.
And under the new system, I mean, one of the things I always figured about the new system was the numbers might be high, but the geography would be different. That's to say, people coming in, earning over the salary cap, having a job. In your constituency, have numbers come down, or is it far less obvious that immigration is as much an issue as it was under freedom of movement when you got those agricultural workers?
So, relatively, yes, numbers have come down, but that's largely because these are largely seasonal agricultural workers. There is a seasonal agricultural scheme. The countries that we used to take those people from now themselves have seasonal worker schemes to try and attract people. So it is... It's much more nuanced than simply being a Brexit conversation. Where the challenge comes still is around, for instance, the local council elections recently were fought very much around people's perception of public safety in the town and community issues that are not so much around cohesion anymore, but they are around pressure on public services and all of that. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a new debate around it post-Brexit, but it's got a lot in common with the previous one as well.
And just quickly, just touching again on the sort of various groups in the Conservative Party, is there a sort of a route for the One Nation group's involvement in the manifesto drafting process? I mean, do people jostle, you know, the various research groups, and I've lost count of them? I mean, you know, does everyone say, well, we need it? I mean, how does that work?
So, I mean, there's a route for everybody, right? And there has been different approaches to writing manifestos over all the elections that I've been involved in, and mm-hmm. some have been incredibly tight, and some have been much longer processes and much more drawn out. Ultimately, it'll be for the PM to decide where he wants to go. But I do think the case that we will make, and obviously we'll continue to make, is look, you can look at the polling and you can look at the practical effects, and those middle ground policies are broadly what people say they're going to vote for. And that is not a way of saying that you should be... I don't think of myself as the nanny state end of the Tory party,
okay.
but I do think of myself as someone who acknowledges that there are certain things only government can do. Mm-hmm. And that might be, some of that is relatively mundane. Some of that is around making sure we have effective nationwide recycling schemes or whatever. Mm. But read the important stuff, but not retail.
And paying for childcare.
Yeah, exactly. Not, but and childcare is very much a retail policy. Mm. Recycling, I chose as an example something that very much isn't, right? And I think we need to acknowledge that the recent history of politics that says deregulate everything, government gets out the way at every opportunity, has not been as politically successful as some people had hoped.
Is the Prime Minister a One Nation Tory?
I think all Prime Ministers, and this sounds like a fudgy answer, and I mean it to genuinely be sincere, I think all Prime Ministers have to ride several different horses, yeah. if that makes sense. I think there are some areas where the PM is much more economically... to the right of most One Nation instincts, and there are some things where he's the other way, and I think that's inherent in the job that he has to do. Mm-hmm. I suppose there are definitely some areas where I would say things like childcare, which even some parts of the Conservative Party are uncomfortable with, should be absolutely core to what we're doing. And I think that's one example of a flagship policy where he's very much on board with it, and I'd characterise it as very much a One Nation policy.
OK, and we hear a lot from Conservative MPs that the Conservative Party is a broad church, but I sort of sometimes get the sense that it's the sort of church where you can't even see one pew from the next, because are you worried that the party itself is becoming ungovernable? Because it just feels and appears very divided day on day to the outsider.
I think these are our respective predecessors, if such a thing exists, have been asking that question for as long as the Tory party has existed.
Yep.
And there's a Labour party metaphorically over the other side of Bush House that's doing the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. When Jeremy Corbyn was in charge, people were yep. saying, this is obviously unsustainable. Mm-hmm. And it turns out, lo and behold, partly because of the electoral system we have, partly because of the strength of the brand, all of that, then everyone always worries that parties are too broad. The reality is, the way you secure a majority in this country is by, I think, having parties that are so broad that they start to strain at the edges, but not so broad that they break. And that is genuinely a sign of strength, and we haven't seen that kind of split for a long time, and I don't think there's any evidence that we're going to see it anytime soon either.
The One Nation group backed Boris Johnson, didn't it, I think?
Mm-hmm. So that's not quite fair. The One Nation has never had a candidate,
right?
But lots of One Nation people back Boris Johnson for a whole host of reasons. Partly because we're not blind to obvious electoral track records, mm-hmm. but also if you look at Boris's record in London in lots and lots of ways, the idea that he was the Brexit Prime Minister and had all of the characteristics of the typical Brexiteer is simply not borne out by the facts. So I think you've got to be, got to acknowledge that in a big group there's always going to be a diversity of views on leadership candidates as well, but also to say inevitably it was obvious at the time that Boris was, I think, the right man for the job.
Would it be fair to say that one of the consequences of Brexit has been to drive the Conservative Party, not in economic but in values terms, to the right? I mean, you lost a lot of the sort of more liberal, the Lidingtons, the Rory Stewarts and so on. And, you know, you've got a lot of new MPs who talk a very different language on cultural matters to One Nation Conservatives.
I'm not sure that's true. I think what Brexit did was reset a huge chunk of the pitch, if that makes sense. And if you look at people who were elected in 2017 and 2019, They are, I think, themselves significantly more diverse in their views and in their backgrounds than the Tory party has been for a long time. That is a huge strength. There's obviously a very live debate about how sustainable that electoral coalition ever was and where it will end up in the future. But it does seem to me that you're right that Brexit reset a lot of things. I'm not sure there's a lot of evidence that it simply shifted everyone to the right. And especially if you look at the people who are 17 and 19 elections and are now in the cabinet, I don't think there's a lot of evidence for that at all.
Okay, you said actually we don't put up a single candidate. Is that something that might change? Why not? I mean, is that something, were there to be, and this is hypothetical upon hypothetical, imagine the Conservatives lost the election and there was a leadership election, why wouldn't the One Nation group put up a candidate? Or might they?
So, well, I'd say is, obviously, within all of those hypotheticals, you can at least look to the past, which is to say, in a big group, you will have a different, you will have a range of people that have a range of views on who is likely to be the most successful person.
Yeah, okay. Now, one of the fascinating, there's loads of fascinating things about you and your position, one of which is that your constituency was found in recent polling to be one of the very, very few places where Brexit is not regretted. Why? Is genuinely interested to know whether there is something specific about your constituency.
There are umpteen answers to that. One of the answers to the direct question is that ultimately it was, we've seen in polling terms, ignore the sort of political arguments, in pure polling terms, you're right to highlight that Brexit support for Brexit has diminished in lots and lots of places. Mine was the constituency that voted for it more than anywhere else. So in pure numerical terms, it's got further to fall. That's a maths point, not a politics point. What I would say is, if you remember the opening of the BBC's coverage on the night of the Brexit referendum. Mm-hmm. In the background, they had, by council, the most likely to vote Remain to the most likely to vote Leave. And Boston Borough Council was, from the very off, most likely to vote Leave by a long way. And that was driven in many ways by immigration, driven by the fact that in 10 years the town had grown by a third, and almost all of that one third of people had come from Eastern Europe, had come to work, had come to do jobs that otherwise would have been vacant, but nonetheless had changed the character of the town immensely, and people didn't feel that that was something there was public consent for. But it is also a part of the world where it is genuinely true. When I was knocking on doors, when I was standing in the marketplace in the run-up to the election, people were talking to me about all the issues that people imagined they were, about sovereignty, about wanting to make their own decisions. And that is a really strong strain across Lincolnshire. Lincolnshire, when we had the first referendum in the 70s, voted very strongly to join the EU, and subsequently voted very strongly to leave the EU. So it has always been at the edge of those debates.
That's interesting. And has it been uncomfortable being the MP for that constituency as a Remainer?
I was really honest from the start. That at the very beginning, my vote is worth no more than anyone else's. As an individual, what I said was powerful, but fundamentally not powerful enough, argument that the Remain campaign made, which is whatever you identify as your problems, Brexit is not the panacea that will fix every single one of them. I think that is, insofar as it goes, that is true. I don't think anyone really would think that it ever was. But what I also said was, look, whatever the result is, I will in Parliament, when I'm representing you, absolutely respect that. And people are much more interested in your actions in Parliament than they are in your individual role at the ballot box. And I think that's been actually quite a rewarding experience in some ways, because for all that politics is personal sometimes, voters understand that your role is to represent them, and when you have a referendum, you do to some extent become a delegate.
Yeah.
And I think that is something that some of my colleagues in Parliament didn't want to accept.
But the referendum vote didn't stipulate a kind of Brexit. I mean, would you like us to have a closer relationship with the European Union than we do?
So I think the premise of the Brexiteer argument actually was that we would have the most mutually advantageous relationship with the EU that we could after we'd left, because it would be obvious that the economics made a certain case, that mm-hmm. that cooperation made sense, whether it's on Horizon, whether it's on a whole host of things. And I think what you are seeing is the gradual maturing of that relationship, mm-hmm. which is still absolutely, it is genuinely hugely important that we respect that result and that there are some real and meaningful dividing lines. But in the maturing of that relationship, we're seeing pragmatic decisions on Horizon. The forthcoming set of checks on goods going across the channel are going to be a real test of how pragmatic are people prepared to be? What does the mixture of pragmatism and bureaucracy end up looking like? And I think that is going to be something where mutual self-interest should be more important than bureaucratic dogma.
But would you and would your colleagues in the One Nation group, for instance, be comfortable? Imagine, again, this hypothetical Labour government. If they come in, it looks like they're going to negotiate things like a veterinary agreement and things like that. Would you like to see those things become wedge issues? Because there'll be some in your party who say, we turn this into a wedge issue. They're reneging on Brexit. But actually, you could argue it's showing exactly the sort of pragmatism you were talking about.
So I think to some extent the devil is in the detail. But my broad answer is what makes it easier and simpler for Joe Public out there to see what is in his or her interest. And I would absolutely say it's in his or her interest for us to look at where does the future growth in trade around the world come from. Mm-hmm. And that means you shouldn't pretend the CPTPP doesn't exist, for instance. But you also shouldn't pretend that there are obvious advantages of being closer to our nearest neighbours than we are to some of our further neighbours.
Okay,
and you can have further neighbours.
Do you think that the whole Brexit saga has impacted on the Conservative Party's relationship with business? I mean, Conservatives used to be the party of business, and one of the things, particularly in the early stages of Brexit, was that relations between the first May government and business seemed almost sort of confrontational on occasion. Do you think that damage is long-lasting?
So I think there are two things. I think fundamentally, important though it is to be talking about the different bits of the Tory party, the conversation that all of us should want to be having is about the Labour Party, is about what the future opportunities a Conservative government could provide will look like and what the future risks of a Labour government will look like. And I think in some ways, I guess that over the 8-9 years I've been doing this, I've discovered I'm a slightly more tribal Tory than I thought. And I think that is, maybe it's because you sort of are up close and personal with the Labour Party to some extent in the chamber. But I really passionately believe that the policies and the values that set up conservative thinking will be better for business, will be better for individuals than those that we're seeing across the other side, no matter how much there might be a pretense that they've changed fundamentally from what they were just a few years ago. And I think we've got a huge job to do, I wouldn't characterise it as post-Brexit, but we've got a huge job to do currently to make the case to the business community that there is a reason why the tax burden is currently where it is, and there is a plan and a genuine prospect of bringing it down while simultaneously improving the public services that ultimately on one level get us elected. So I think that's a very long-winded way of saying we have got a job to do. That is a challenge. But I think the idea that sort of business is somehow separate from politics is not quite right. Like you talk when I was Minister for Broadband, talking to big chief execs of major companies, they understood that there was a political necessity for the way we were approaching Brexit. That didn't mean that they also thought that there wasn't a conversation to be had about what policies that were business friendly might look like.
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, the sort of economic pitch you made, would you be uncomfortable if the party went towards the next election majoring on immigration, leaving the ECHR and things like that? Because there are some people in your party who seem to think that that's the path.
Well, I'd be uncomfortable because I think it wouldn't be a vote-winning opportunity. I think, and I've said publicly lots, I think the ECHR needs some really fundamental reform.
Yeah.
And I think the Refugee Convention needs some really fundamental reform. And I think there's lots of those big, in the Rwanda Bill, there's half a dozen of the big treaties sort of named explicitly, and no one thinks any of them is perfect. And I think you do have to countenance the prospect that if you sit there and say something needs really fundamental reform and you don't get it, and you're saying it's fundamentally broken, what do you do then? And I think that's an open question. At that point, you have to say, well, okay, this is what the best looks like, and this is what not being in it might look like, and how do you make that call? But my starting point is it's in everyone's interest, for instance, to pursue multilaterally that reform programme. I don't think that while there are, of course, significant numbers of people who would say it is immigration and ECHR that is the crucial issue for the next election. I think the reality is, and the polling says, that it is the economy, it is the NHS, it is public services. And so wedge issues are important. They demonstrate whose side you're on, but they can't be the main debate.
And do you get uncomfortable with some of the wedge issues? I mean, what is the trans issue has been in the news a lot after PMQs last week and things like that. Do you sort of think, actually, we could dial this down a bit? I mean, it's not very one nation, is it?
So I worry that sometimes we talk about things in a way that obscure the big picture, right? And I think that is that is an important starting point. I do think that it is not for politicians of any flavour to reach too far into people's personal lives and to take the trans debate as just one example. There are huge chunks of that debate where it is for the state to consider what it means for aspects of health policy, what it means for aspects of prisons policy, those are important. But in the vast majority of cases, I believe in letting people live their own lives according to their own choices. And that means that you can stay out of a lot of it.
Well, but it also means that in some areas the state has to step in to ensure that people have the freedom to live those lives.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that does. So, to take another example of buffer zones around abortion clinics, for instance, where there are strong views amongst the people of sort of strongly held faith of both parties around lots of this stuff. And I think what I've always voted for, what I think lots of people are on, I wouldn't split it solely along this, but what lots of One Nation is for, that legislating to allow people to get on with doing difficult things in difficult circumstances unimpeded by other people's views. And I think you can have a big policy debate about trans issues or abortion or whatever, that is not the same thing as permitting personally provocative protest.
Okay. I mean, the other issue that has looked like it might be a wedge issue has been net zero. What do you make of the Prime Minister's, well, I'm trying to think of the appropriate word, softening, if you like, of government policy or slight shifts to government policy? Has that concerned you that, I mean, there are signs, I mean, they're more marked in other countries than this one at the moment, that this is becoming politicised and is turning into an issue where the right in particular is saying, you know, we should push back on this.
So I think, again, I do tend to look to the constituency. So mine is a big rural constituency, huge numbers of people off the mains, gas grids, lots of people where the idea that you're going to, I know, the banning wood burners conversation, for instance, that is simply not viable. And the Prime Minister's softening the slope from one place to another, to me, in an area like mine, for lots of issues, is simply the only practical option. Like that, you can be wishful thinking about heat pumps and all of that, but it is not always the plan that you can pursue. What I do think, on a sort of higher level than the parochial, if you like, is we do have to say people saying more than anything else they care about this issue in theory. We know it's the
in your constituency included.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And we know that it's the right thing to do from a climate point of view. We've got to find a way of doing the challenging dual thing that people failed to do around when they wanted to win the Remain argument for Brexit, is to say, look, it's not just pragmatically in your interest to do this, but you've got to believe in it. You've got to win the argument as well as get a stick out, whether it's taxation or banning gas boilers or whatever. And I think there are some parts of the country, be it geographically, where they might be particularly rural, where that argument is a long way from won. And it is not just for government to play that role, but I do think it shouldn't be the case that you end up in a position where you say, look, we can leave this for the next generation, because at some point you run out of generations.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I find most irritating about the debate is this slightly sort of patronising attitude in the South that, you know, the oiks up north aren't going to support net zero, are they? And actually, there's no polling that supports this whatsoever. I mean, but there's some very lazy assumptions about, you know, those voters won't want to buy into this. And
so I think we get dangerously close to those the polls that said sort of people who voted for Brexit were less educated and that sort of thing. And I think there are two problems with it. So that sort of one, scratch the surface and it's not wholly true. Two, the votes of people who are less educated or live in different places are not worth less than the votes of people who are more educated. You've got to grapple with that and you've got to win arguments in different ways.
So just panning out, what parts of the Conservative Party's record since 2019 are you most proud of?
Well, I think if you look at post-2019, actually delivering... When we came in after that election, then it was in a real democratic crisis. We ended up having that election because Parliament was fundamentally broken. We had a fixed-term Parliaments Act that was working in theory really well, right up until Parliament had to do something really difficult.
Yep.
And I think actually of course the pandemic has shifted huge chunks of this. But you do have to say cutting the Gordian knot that was Brexit is, in order to move the political debate on, is something that was an absolute necessity. Mm-hmm. I think it's fair to look at the sort of longer Conservative trajectory rather than simply since 2019 and say whether it's school standards, whether it's equal marriage, whether it's the rise of the British tech scene in a way that is absolutely unprecedented anywhere around the world, given where we started from, there are huge chunks of things that the Tory party should be very much on the front foot fighting the next election on. And that's partly about pride in the record, but it's also partly about saying, look, do you really think that there were better options available, and do you really think that an alternative party would have made better choices? And I think we should be braver and more confident about making that case. And that doesn't mean getting angry about it, and it doesn't mean promising more political excitement than perhaps we've had in the last few years, but it does mean saying, look, it is, you take education as one example, it is a pure fact that since the Conservatives have been in power, we have rocketed up the lead, up the international tables in English, in maths, in research, in all that. So I think there's lots to be proud of, and there's a danger that we buy into the sort of nihilistic narrative around the world.
I can't remember what the issue was that week when the PISA things came out that showed that we'd gone up, and I was absolutely struck by the fact that the Prime Minister went off on some cultural thing, and I was thinking... Sure, you should be talking about...
I think events might have intervened in the government grid, perhaps. I think it is absolutely true that those things are things that we should be talking about. There is a whole generation of children that have been through schools under a Conservative government that have proportionally, if you like, got better results than their predecessors did under a Labour government. You can talk about unemployment, you can talk about the economy, you can talk about all of these things. We should be confident and proud of that, and we should be talking about it in a way that makes it clear that there is a lot at stake come the next election. And I think that doesn't mean deviating from that centre ground, it means making the case in the centre ground.
But on education, are you slightly concerned that the government has slightly failed to deal with the issue of sort of COVID catch-up. I mean, you had the you had the education czar who resigned, Kevin Collins, saying we need 15 billion for COVID catch-up, and the government provided, I think, 1.4 or something. Are you, does that not concern you that actually there is, there are a lot of kids, particularly kids from deprived backgrounds, who, because of COVID, are going to just fall further behind?
So I think you're absolutely right that there is a huge, there is a catch-up generation, if you like. And there we've got sort of, there are two generations that, that worry me, if you like. One, from a sort of political appeal point of view. One is, and I'm not that far away from this myself, one is people who came of age in the wake of the financial crash. And they are people where essentially wages have stagnated for 15 years. And that is, there are good reasons why things couldn't have been done particularly differently or better, but it's a hard political argument.
Yeah.
And the other is, as you say, the people who were at school and their parents during that period, where there is a lot of things that we could have done with money, there are, but there are lots of things that, that money couldn't buy, the kind of new approach that we need to try and deal with the mental health consequences of COVID, that we try, that we need to try and deal with the, there is lots of evidence of changing attitude to just simply going to school. We shouldn't underestimate the
persistent absenteeism.
We shouldn't underestimate the cultural impact of COVID, as well as the as well as the sort of pure educational catch-up.
But surely the biggest single issue your party faces is that you've lost the reputation for economic competence, and history suggests you don't win that back until the other party loses theirs. So if you take the broad sweep of history, you've got Black Wednesday. And actually, when is that reversed? It's reversed in 2008 when Labour had the great financial crisis. And when is that reversed? It's reversed with the mini budget and Liz Truss. I mean, there's nothing you can do about that, is there?
Well, I think there's reality and there's reputation. You can make a very good case for Britain's relative success post-pandemic and outside the EU, whether you want to get hung up on the inside inside or outsideness of the UK. You can make a really good case for conservative policies delivering growth that has simply not happened in lots of our sort of competitor countries. Now, I would like ours to be even better than it is, and frankly, I'd like theirs to be better than it is as well. This isn't a winners and losers kind of conversation. But you're right that there are some facts that you can get out there. You can talk about employment, you can talk about inflation. People can see and feel those records, and they can see and feel the tax cuts that are made possible by them. You've also got to have a perception conversation. And I think trying to sell that future vision in a credible way is why, on the one hand, I absolutely want the Chancellor to spend every single penny of headroom he's got come the next budget. What I don't want him to do is spend any more than that, because the way that you could really further damage the Conservative Party's reputation on the economy would be to leave something that didn't feel credible.
And that headroom is, to an extent, is fictional, isn't it? Because, I mean, the projections for the next 3 or 4 years that say, OK, we're going to meet the target of the fiscal rule are based on spending projections that are just politically unsustainable, surely. I mean, the scale of cuts that are implied in the spending plans for 26, 27, 28 are just not politically deliverable.
Well, I think the straight answer to your question is that the headroom is dictated by forecasts, right? And those forecasts are real things that that provide an actual envelope. You are, I think, right that there are going to be, whoever's in power, some really tough conversations over the next few years, some of which is basically about, look, we've got huge challenges, be they the sort of legacy cost of COVID, be they inflation, be they the sort of broader consequences of war in Europe on our doorstep, and we're going to have, I think, an obvious need to spend more on defence than we have relatively recently over the next few years, because we face different and greater threats. So there's going to be some big potential increases required.
Yep.
And there's going to be a sensible conversation that needs to be had around how you make some sensible savings in places. So I'm not disputing in some ways
No, it's a tight fiscal environment.
Yeah, exactly. But I do think we've got to be honest with the public in the way that, at the end of the day, both Labour and the Conservative Party in 2010 were promising cuts. They were saying, we are going to make the books work. And the public understood that. Being honest with people about what the environment is really going to look like is really important. That's not the same thing as saying that we have to relive the post-2010 austerity by any means.
But in that, I mean, given all that, it's hardly helpful, is it, that so many of your colleagues in this fiscal environment are banging on about tax cuts? That's hardly fiscally responsible, is it?
So I think there is a balance here, right? Mm-hmm. The tax burden is at enormously high levels historically. It's not delivering the public services that people think they are paying for.
Yeah.
Now you have to have a conversation, I think, that either says, right, do you think what we should be doing is putting taxes up and up and up and up, and then you will magically get the NHS you think you're paying for?
Yeah.
Or are you going to be able to say, look, the way that you deliver what you need is around pragmatic reform and around saying that it is not always the highest tax rates that deliver the highest amount into the Treasury.
Hang on, I've lost my voice now. I'm sort of confusing myself. Bear with me. Does it matter? When I was listening to the radio this morning, listening to the Today programme, we were talking about recessions, technical recessions and all of this. When you talk to your constituents, does that resonate? Is that an issue?
So I think...
I mean, obviously it matters if the economy isn't doing very well, sure,
yeah,
but
yeah,
does this...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think no one has ever said to me, I'm furious GDP is at minus 0.3, it should be at minus 0.1, or whatever.
Like
the difference between a technical recession and anything else is not what people talk about. What people do talk about is inflation, are the things that make you feel richer or poorer. And I think, for instance, there was a period when inflation was massively outstripping wage rises. It's now, wage rises are now slightly outstripping inflation. So I think where people feel they are is much more important than what the OBR has come up with. That's important. Of course it's important, and it's what sets the envelope for you to make those decisions. But I don't think, in the main, when people talk to me about, so what are the big issues, they are dentists, they are potholes, they are the sort of table stakes basic stuff. The answer to those people is never, well, if GDP was a bit higher, then we could fix more potholes. But that is the answer, right? On one level. You've got to have those conversations on its own.
But you don't say GDP was like, you say growth. That's
well, even if you say growth, sort of a bit with the exception of some of my colleagues in Parliament, most people's eyes do glaze over. Mm-hmm. So I think you have to have these conversations in the language that people come to you with. In the same way that if someone emails me, I'll email them back rather than send them a letter, kind of thing. Like you've got to, I think, have that. You've got to be able to have an eye on what does communication look like. It does matter. Of course it matters. But what people say matters is the things that feel more immediate.
Yeah. Talking about glazing over, I saw this fantastic Harold Wilson quote the other day when he was asked, what is the art of dealing with a difficult question in politics? And apparently Harold Wilson said, well, I've got a trick for this. If you start your answer with, as we discussed in Parliament last week, no one listens to the second half of your answer because they're so bored already. So there's a trick you might want to try. You're doing a remarkably good job at spinning a sort of relatively upbeat picture here. But I mean, let's face it, the mood amongst your colleagues in the Parliamentary Conservative Party is going to be pretty low at the moment. There is a morale.
Well, it's got a lot better over the last week. I would say. That's a slightly glib answer, but the underlying truth behind it is I sincerely believe that if you look at what happens to Labour policy under any kind of scrutiny, if you look at the reality of the judgments that Keir Starmer's made over the last few weeks, it's no longer the case that you have to say, look at Wales and you can see how Labour will govern and their waiting lists are far longer and their track record is far worse and every speed limit is now 20 miles an hour. Like, do you really want to live there? You don't have to even say that anymore. What you can say is look at the decisions that Keir Starmer is making, even as leader of the opposition. Do you really want his Labour Party running the country? And I think that is something that should inspire, does inspire, much greater unity. And on one level, albeit in relatively bleak circumstances, much greater optimism amongst Conservative colleagues. I've always looked at those polls and thought we are not facing an opposition that deserves that lead. And there is a national interest case, there is a moral case, and there is a really practical look at the other guy's case for a really good Conservative performance at the next election.
So that sort of unity is going to prove quite fragile if you lose two by-elections tonight, isn't it?
Are we allowed to talk about by-elections yet? I think...
Just quickly.
When do the polls close? So look, all I would say is you look at the previous by-elections, then there is a lot of reason for Conservatives to be pessimistic. If you look at the history of by-elections under governments of all flavours over parliaments going back 100 years, they are not the best predictor for general election results, and quite right too. And most of that is because the turnout's about half what it would be in the election.
Yeah, OK, fair enough. I'm going to break with tradition and take a question from... I'm taking a question from Slido because it says it's from Patrick Bamford, and someone obviously knows their way to my heart as one of my favourite footballers, and it gives you a chance to do your pitch. As a One Nation Conservative Party member of many years who left the party because of Brexit, Johnson and Truss, why should I come back?
Oh, I think if you look at what this current Conservative Party is offering, it is about saying there is a huge track record that we should be proud of, there is all of that stuff, whether it is education, whether it's the way that we have navigated the challenges that have faced the country recently, all of those things indicate that this is an election that will be fought and won in the centre ground. Mm-hmm. And if you really want to, at the risk of sounding like the CCHQ lines, they are.
Well, this has teed you up for that, hasn't it?
They are. That, thank you, Patrick. They are.
Imagine if it is Patrick Bamford. This is so exciting.
There is CCHQ undercover. there is a real argument to say, do you really want to go back to all of those problems that were inherited in 2010? And there is a real argument to say, do you really want to trust a set of arguments from a party that won't say what it will do because it doesn't have a plan? Like that, all of those lines, which you'll hear time and time again, they are not just lines, they are a real case for sensible political decision making.
But isn't the fundamental flaw that if you say, do you want to go back to square one, a large number of people say, yeah, actually.
I mean, I think that you're right that there are a number of people who would say they don't like the square we're currently in.
Yeah.
I think what the party has to do is to keep making the case that it's easy to say you've been in power for however many years and everything is not perfect. What we do have to do is keep talking about all of those achievements, which is something not all of which everyone will like, and say, look, there is a real risk that a lot of that is jeopardised, and there is a huge risk that for all the sort of ostensible superficial changes, that the party that people are thinking about electing hasn't changed in anything like the ways that Keir Starmer might wish. And we see that in the debacle over Rochdale, we see that in the debacle over how people voted with the most recent ceasefire vote, we'll see it in the next ceasefire vote on Wednesday. I think there are lots and lots of really good reasons to be profoundly sceptical about the suggestion that the Labour Party has changed in anything like the way that Keir Starmer might wish.
Voting for a ceasefire is not being anti-Semitic.
No, I'm not suggesting it is, but what I am saying is that the idea that you have got a suddenly unified Labour Party, it's simply not true. And I think you've got to...
It's a broad church.
Yeah, exactly. It's a broad church, but it's the broad church that was rightly saw the result that it got under Jeremy Corbyn. And I do come back to the things that lots of my constituents say. They will say that, is this the Keir Starmer who wanted Jeremy Corbyn to be Prime Minister, or the Keir Starmer that wants Keir Starmer to be Prime Minister? Like, you've got to put your colours out there and say, what are you prepared to do to get power? And if you're really going to go as far as Keir Starmer has gone, that is a challenging set of environments for people to make a pitch from.
I mean, I've got to ask you this. I mean, given your expertise and your former career, as the election approaches, how worried are you and should we be about disinformation, deepfakes?
Very is the short answer. If I'm honest, I'm more worried about the impact of all of that on the US elections, which will probably come before ours. And I think
you heard it here first.
You've heard it from most other people as well. If you've heard it here first, you weren't listening. I think that is obviously a magnet for all of those bad actors, and I think it is also going to be a test case for lots and lots of things. And we will be there is danger that we're the sort of second version of some of that. And I think there is lots of it to be genuinely worried about. The real problem in some ways is not that it's not illegal yet. Like, we've got lots of really good legislation that says you can't do this, that, and the other in pursuit of someone's vote. What we haven't got is the technology to stop it happening. So it's more of an implementation crisis than it is a policy crisis.
I have to say, I've been out there recently, that I think that India is going to be a proving ground for a lot of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because of the proliferation of technology and so much tech savvy, that I think the Indian election is going to be absolutely haunted by this. But so, I mean, you were a journalist. You worked at the Telegraph before coming into politics. And I suppose one question I'd just like to know is, did politics live up to what you thought it would? I mean, what has politics disappointed you? Has it sort of exceeded expectations? I mean, you weren't to know you were entering for the period that you've witnessed.
No. I think people always sort of, the first question, and you haven't fallen into this trap, the first question that people ask is, why did you want to do something that was so fundamentally different from what you were doing before? And my sort of part of my job every year was to go and review the new iPhone, sort of when people were literally sleeping outside to queue up for it.
Yeah.
So it was a pretty cool thing to be doing, and an amazing thing to be paid to do. And people were like, that's so different from what you're going to do now. And actually, I think there's a huge amount of common ground. Is that it's about being. Most of journalism is about talking to people and building coalitions, if you like, in some ways, of people who want to talk to you. And the bit of journalism that I was doing was largely about trying to actually, for all the sort of excitement of reviewing iPhones, it was more about trying to nudge government into a certain policy direction, whether it was around broadband or online safety or whatever. So I didn't actually sort of come into it thinking these are radically different things.
Okay.
But I did think that it is something where you are closer to being on the pitch than being a spectator. But I think even all of the sort of arguably backbenchers feel like they're spectators, and junior ministers feel like they're spectators to the cabinet, and cabinet ministers feel like they're spectators to number 10. And it's like, actually, it turns out that all of this is about coalition building.
I don't know. Did you read Paul Waugh's piece? And did that resonate with you? So, I mean, there was a bit about the actor, not a spectator.
For good and bad reasons, it resonated. I think I absolutely sympathise with the desire to be on the pitch or in the ring or whatever you want to call it. I think at the same time, the amount of time the politician spends asking themselves what the media says, you're constantly wondering who has the greater power.
Okay, but do you feel like, I mean, have you felt like you were on the pitch, or has it felt like being a bystander in Parliament?
No, absolutely. I mean, I think it is wrong to say that backbenchers of either party are simply spectators. It's obviously wrong to say that ministers are simply spectators. You have a different platform and a different opportunity to use it. Obviously, ministers, to some extent, are making executive decisions, but they're not making them in a vacuum. Backbenchers have a platform to nudge or even literally change those decisions. So I think it's about learning how to do the things you can do from the place that you're in. And if you sort of set your sights on one position or one whatever, then you're only going to drive yourself mad. You've got to use that. You've got to use the tools that you've got to the best of your abilities.
And just because you mentioned the media, I mean, are you concerned by the changes in the media landscape? I mean, there's been a lot of arguments about GB News, about the sight of, you know, Conservative MPs interviewing Conservative ministers.
So I think there's some bits where Ofcom has got some catching up to do. Mm-hmm. And I think there are, because they face a, which is not a criticism of them, we face a different set of circumstances where regulators haven't had to work out what that means. Come an election, then once you become a candidate, then you won't be able, those sorts of things won't be permitted anyway. And I think we need to ask ourselves what that should look like in peacetime, so to speak. Mm. What I guess...
I mean, in the interest of balance, I should add that, you know, we're going to have Labour peer Aisha Hazarika interviewing Labour ministers quite possibly as well, so it's not limited to...
Yeah, exactly. I should have thought of that myself.
There we go, that's for free.
Thank you. but to be fair, like, it's never been a secret of where, I'm sure she wouldn't mind me saying this, it's never been a secret where Aisha's politics were before she was put into the House of Lords.
But it's different being a legislator.
It is... But if you're interested in balance, then you're interested in balance. And obviously, sort of that's tipped it even further in one direction, but it hasn't fundamentally changed the dynamic, I don't think. I have mixed feelings about the increasing... So if you look at something like LBC, much more of the sort of... James O'Brien, a very, very left-wing commentator. You look at some of the people on GB News or on the other end of the spectrum. I broadly think that most of this stuff is talking to strands of thought that are already out there. And if we pretended that this stuff didn't exist and we tried to put the genie back in the bottle, then we would only be storing up greater pressure for later. So I think we've got to tread carefully, but we shouldn't pretend that there is no one in Britain that thinks that GB News is a brilliant idea, and lots of it I think is a brilliant idea. And I might not think the same about some bits of LBC, but vice versa. Like, the plurality is a huge strength, and the broad church of the media is just as much a strength as the broad church of political parties.
Excellent. Well, we've run out of time, but not quite, because we have the best bit now, which is our quickfire round, on which you are going to be judged by your colleagues. So it's a series of quickfire one-word answers.
The answer is always both.
Okay, here we go. BBC or Netflix?
BBC.
Guardian or GB News? Ooh.
Can I say both or neither?
So phone a friend. USA or EU?
What for?
Well, generally.
I'm not very good at quickfire rounds, am I?
Well, that's all right. There have been people who have been a lot worse than you, I have to say.
Yeah, I think you have to have both. I'm not going to choose.
Okay, Prince Harry or Piers Morgan?
What for?
I dread to think.
Yeah, exactly.
I think you're overthinking this.
Yeah, exactly. I think Piers Morgan's a better journalist.
Okay, Greggs or Pret?
Greggs.
Hotel or Airbnb?
Airbnb.
Tofu or sausages?
Sausages.
Levelling up or cutting taxes? Leveling. Don't say there's no tension between the two. I mean,
there's no tension between the two, but I fancy levelling up if I have to choose.
All right, okay. Bike or car?
Car.
EV or SUV?
EV.
Beer or wine?
Yes.
Sciences or humanities?
I did an English degree. I think I have to say humanities.
Okay, fair enough. Football or rugby?
Rugby.
Oh, dear. Twitter or TikTok?
Twitter, if I have to.
Cash or contactless?
Contactless.
LTNs, yes or no?
Yeah, all right. Depends if you think they're some sort of globalist conspiracy.
Oh, you'll do. Imperial or metric?
Metric. I'm not that old.
Okay. And finally, Sunak or Cameron?
Both.
Oh, Lord. Matt Woolman, thank you very much indeed. You can clap now. A pregnant pause, wasn't it?